Episode 276 of the Pilot to Pilot podcast takes off now. Fly with Garmin Avionics? Then grab your mobile device and make the Garmin Pilot app your cockpit companion. Get advanced functions you'll use before, during, and after every flight, including updating your aircraft's databases and logging engine data. Plan, file, fly, log with Garmin Pilot. The Pilot to Pilot podcast is brought to you by Learn the Finer Points. Use the link below to save 10% off their ground school app. Today's episode is brought to you by Bose Aviation. Quiet the noise, amplify the experience. The Bose A30 Aviation headset is the best combination of comfort, audio clarity, and active noise cancellation on the market. Transform your flying experience at bose.com/A30.
Jim Higgins, professor at the University of North Dakota.
Aviation, what is going on? And welcome back to the Pilot to Pilot podcast. My name is Justin Seams and I am your host. Today's episode is a state of the industry episode where we answer all of your questions. Make sure you're following Pilot to Pilot on Instagram so you can have your question answered on the next episode. Today, we dive pretty deep into what the industry is doing, and I think it's a great episode. Shout out to Jim Higgins for always coming on these podcasts and just really sounding so smart because he makes me look so much better. But Jim, I appreciate it, and I hope you guys enjoy this episode. As I said before, make sure you're following Pilot to Pilot for the opportunity to have your question answered by Jim and I. So Aviation, without any further ado, here's State of the Industry with Dr. Jim Higgins. Jim, what's going on, man? Welcome back to the Pilot to Pilot podcast.
Justin, happy to be here. Happy to always talk with you and your listeners.
Yeah, I guess I should say the State of the Industry podcast. You know, this
absolutely
is exactly what it is instead of a Pilot to Pilot podcast, but we'll figure that out later.
How we want to go about good. That.
So yeah, it's been a couple weeks, a month or so since we've recorded and talked about this. So there's probably been some updates in the industry. Thought it was time to have a new episode out.
Absolutely. It's a fast-moving, dynamic environment for sure. Always something. Every day, there's always something that you can talk about.
Yeah. Well, I guess I should say, make sure you follow Pilot to Pilot because I put up today a question on my Instagram and it said, hey, do you have any questions for Jim and I? If you do, just go ahead and ask them here and we'll try to talk about them on the show. So we're sitting at quite a few questions. I sent them to you. You didn't realize there's more than one page. You're probably like, dang, Justin gets no questions. But we got some good questions here that we'll go through. I didn't know if there's anything off the top of your head that you wanted to talk about at all or anything that was kind of glaring. I know we talked in the pre-recording that FedEx and American, they have an agreement in principle. Whether that gets passed or not, we shall see. But it seems promising for them. And like we said, it leaves United and Southwest left. So I guess we can just start off with that because that's probably what most people really care about.
Absolutely. Yeah, those were pretty good events over the last 2 weeks. And you're right. It is just an agreement in principle. And having been at the negotiating table, there's a lot of process left. What that generally means is both sides having an understanding, at least a verbal understanding. And then what generally happens is you go through what's called like a subcommittee that will write the language. Sometimes you give it to the lawyers if there's some particular complexities to it, one from the company and your own attorney from the union, and they'll write it out. And then, you'll exchange language back and forth to make sure you encapsulate and capture what it is you thought you talked about at the table. And sometimes there's a bit of a process there. Sometimes people are like, well, wait a minute, we didn't agree to that. But generally speaking, 99% of the time, the language gets wordsmithed a little bit and encapsulates what was said. Then it goes back to the MEC or the executive board of the particular union. They will ratify it and then decide whether or not to send it, if they do ratify it, decide whether or not to send it out to the rank and file pilots. And it's 50% plus one vote is how it would be passed.
Yeah. And the companies usually try to figure out a way to get to 50 plus one. That's what they want. They don't want to give anything else. 50 plus one. That's it.
Well, that's true. And, the truth is every individual airline and group of pilots, they're going to have different, what, for lack of a better word, stratifications, which means you may have a very senior group. You may have a much smaller gap maybe for your mid-level. And then, of course, with all the hiring going on, a lot of people that aren't off probation yet who generally will not vote on a contract. So those are kind of interesting things. And so, different people at different phases in their career, they have different priorities, obviously. When you're, you're probably an FO, a junior FO, one of your big priorities is going to be pay. And it's always going to be pay for everybody, but that might be one of your biggest priorities. Whereas maybe somebody that's looking a little closer to retirement may be more interested in things like retiree medical bolstering or something along those lines. And so, you know, that's the trick. How do you get this ratified with the group? The idea is, anyway, is that, you know, you put enough in there for everybody that there's enough people. And I guess in the case that we were just talking about, 50% plus one says, yeah, that's good enough for me.
Who's under the most pressure right now, would you say, between companies and unions? I mean, right now, the pilot group is expecting a huge payday, no matter what company you're working for. Do you think those pilots are putting more pressure on their unions or their companies, or even in the actual kind of management versus union? Who do you think? Because if an airline doesn't give out a world-class contract, it's not going to pass, and then they're not going to get pilots. But there's also some kind of, if the union doesn't get everything the pilot group thinks, it could be a lot of trouble in the future for the union.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, conventional wisdom would say right now the pressure's on the companies, on the managements, to get really good contracts in place. I don't know if that's the case at United and Southwest. It just, for whatever reason, things have really gone to a really, really slow process. I guess perhaps if you're a line pilot, that's what you're thinking. Maybe management thinks that they're moving fast. I know that's a topic for debate for sure. But I don't know if that, you know, like I said, I don't know if that's the case. I do know that a lot of unions, I mean, United had a huge shakeup with their NEC. They had a lot of people that were recalled, union representatives. They had a brand new negotiating committee. If you recall, there was a contract that was, they did get an AIP on, this was several months ago, and was ultimately rejected by 94% of the membership. That's a big disconnect. That demonstrates a huge disconnect between what the pilots were expecting and what the union delivered. So in the case of United, I would say there's a lot of pressure on the representatives to deliver, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting. As a union pilot where I fly, we have been surveyed and surveyed and surveyed and surveyed, and then additional surveys on what we want. And I would imagine that United at that time did the same thing, but maybe they just really truly didn't grasp the actual climate that we're in right now, where this is completely different and you ask for the moon and then some and you expect it. It's not like old negotiations where you're praying that you get anything extra and don't want to give anything up. It's like, no, you ask for this and that. You get them both. You eat your cake and what's the saying? You eat your pie and your cake or your dinner.
Yeah, you get your cake and you eat it too, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's the kind of market that pilots are expecting right now.
Well, absolutely. And it's realistic because you can just look and see what happened at Delta. You can see what happened at American. I haven't seen all the details of the American contract, but by all accounts, it looks pretty good. I mean, from my outside perspective, my guess is it'll pass there. And FedEx, I'm sure we'll see there too, how that is. But having negotiated contracts during concessionary times and having negotiated some contracts when times were a little bit better, there certainly is a difference, you know, and the expectations are very much that. Of course, I know I've mentioned this before, when times are tough, you know, you generally, from the union point of view, go for things that are a little more long term, like job security, furlough protection, retirement, perhaps, things like that. And when times are good, you kind of go for the money and the immediate stuff. And then, like you said, all the other extras because the company's flush. This is a particularly interesting time, obviously, because the framework and the pattern has been set by the other carriers. And, you know, ALPA has been well known, and most labor groups for a long time have been known to follow pattern bargaining, right? And you generally, we've talked about this before, but you generally work on what's in the industry and you elevate off of that and try to achieve more. And so they've got that going for them. We've got, you know, the fact that there's been some bonus packages and high salaries paid out for a lot of the CEOs and upper management folks during the pandemic. And, you know, the people that were on the front line, not all of them have seen the contracts yet, and they haven't really been able to share in that as well. So there's, you know, a lot of angst there as well.
Yeah. And this next kind of question, it kind of has to do with contracts. I'm sure they're going to want their own contract soon, but someone said, that guy Kai, he goes, how are things looking for Atlas now that they're privately owned? I didn't realize that one kind of snuck under the rug that Atlas was bought by a private equity firm.
Yeah, so private equity in general is really interesting. We have seen this before. Generally, you see it sometimes on the regionals. You didn't really see it a whole lot on some of the larger carriers, which I would include Atlas in as well. And so, you know, it just depends when private equity takes over. We could talk about private equity for hours, but generally speaking, the private equity folks that come in, they don't require as much of a return, and there's not quite as big a risk as say like a venture capitalist, but a private equity person will certainly want to see some pretty good returns. And one of the ways they try to safeguard that is they'll take and put their own people in upper management. And, you know, the problem with that sometimes is when you do that in the airline world, you get people in there perhaps that maybe aren't as experienced at running an airline or, you know, a private organization like that, where there's a lot of regulation and a lot of issues you don't normally see in other businesses. So time's going to have to tell on that one. Of course, the overall outlook for Atlas is still strong simply because of the Amazon connection. The growth for Amazon is still looking very, very good, and they have a lot of that flying. I don't see, you know, any downward trend there at all. But the private equity group is there to make money. And so there could be weird things that happen. This isn't to scare anybody, but I mean, you never know. They're going to look to make a profit probably somewhere in the 4 to 8 year time horizon from acquisition to where they go through their exit. It's generally not a long-term hold for them. I mean, there's exceptions to that. So the point is you might see in the 4 to 8 year point, you can start seeing this if you're a pilot there, start paying attention to fleet plans. You know, if you start seeing new orders come in, or if you start seeing planes returned on lease towards the end of that period, these are some of the canaries in the cave or the canaries in the coal mine that might indicate what's going to happen next. But it is a private company now, so a lot of the filings aren't going to have to be made that you would normally see with a public company. And that's often how we get a lot of information. You know, that's how we know when United's looking at profitability or American's looking at a bad quarter, whatever the case may be, because they have to announce all that and release it. You don't have to do that when you're a private company.
I mean, my guess, just like not having many information and knowledge of this at all, would be that they're positioning to try to eventually have Amazon purchase them outright, and someone sees the opportunity to buy now, and hopefully Amazon's like, dang, all right, we can't do this on our own. We need just to buy someone. So why don't we buy Atlas?
So Amazon and creating their own airline has always been an interesting one for me. You know, and full disclosure, I have met with the folks in Seattle at Amazon that are responsible for the air group a few years ago. And we had some pretty good talks. This was just some pilot supply issue stuff that we had talked to them about. I will tell you, very, very smart people. Their president of their airline just moved on to another part of Amazon as part of a promotion. She was a former F-14 pilot and really, really impressive. And I'm sure they'll have more impressive people come in behind her. Again, nobody knows what the future holds. A private equity play would certainly make sense if their plan is to prep it for a purchase by Amazon. That would certainly be within the realm of possibility. I would also say by this point in time, Amazon certainly has the people that know how to run an airline, and they also have the money. They have the capital reserves. So I'd be a little surprised by now that they haven't already done that. Apparently, they're able to achieve what they want to achieve by using the different air carriers out there and contracting with the different folks. We might have talked about this before, but it does remind me a lot of UPS around, when was it, late 1980s. They also had about 4 or 5 air carriers that were taking care of their overnight business. Evergreen was one, Flying Tigers, I think, was another one, Orion was one. And so what they did is all of a sudden one day they just said, okay, we're now going to form our own airline. And they basically worked out a deal where they took chunks of all these 4 carriers and brought them on board and painted everything brown and called it UPS. So I don't know if that's going to happen. You know, there's also one other interesting little nugget that would absolutely piss off the labor union folks. But technically speaking, and this is I don't know if the FAA would ever go for it, but a very interesting thing with an Amazon airline is if Amazon is only moving its own internal freight from point A to point B, its own company goods to transport for sale, and it's not holding itself out to the public, it's not selling carriage, you know, there's an argument it could even be a 91 operation, which of course, a lot of people get really mad when they hear that because they're like, that's not what 91, you know, charter was supposed to be. It wasn't meant to be 767s and 777s and all this stuff. But technically speaking, if you look at the letter of the law, you could make an argument. Now, I'll tell you politically, it would be fought like there's no tomorrow because at 91, of course, your rule set is a lot, well, from a management point of view, a lot more flexible. From a pilot point of view, horrible, could be horrible.
That's really interesting. I didn't even think about that. I mean, yeah, I would imagine. I mean, they say that's not how it's written, but that's how the game's played, you know? It's like you play how the rules are set. And right now the rules are set that there could be a loophole. Well, not really a loophole because that's how it's written. But there could be a way that they could pull that off, which would be pretty wild. But like you said, they have some smart people there. So I'm sure they're aware of that by now. So they, I don't know. Like I said, it makes sense, but it also makes sense that if Amazon is happy with what they're doing, then why go after it?
Right. Yeah. And there's a lot to be said for, for lack of a better word, outsourcing your group. There's a lot of things that you don't have to worry about. So it seems to be working for them now. They might say to themselves, we've never meant to be an airline. We've simply always meant to be, a worldwide marketplace. And, they had a very well covered falling out with FedEx several years ago. That was the idea at that time. Were they going to go to their own airline? And to your other comment, I 100% know for a fact that Amazon is aware of the 91, for lack of a better word, loophole. I don't know that they have the will to ever go down that, because it would just cause, an unbelievable amount of political overhang. My guess is even if the FAA were to say, okay, well, it is allowed, there would be years of tie-ups in the court over that.
Yeah. And I guess one big holdup would also be the liability of having your certificate on the line, or like Amazon has a plane crash and kills people. Like, it's a lot different than Southern Air or whoever they have operating, It's like they can kind of wipe their hands clean and be like, that wasn't us. But if it actually says Amazon, it's a much different scenario.
Right. No, that's exactly the case. There's all kinds of things like that. And truthfully, right now, with the way the environment is, as a pilot, I don't know that I'd want to entertain that.
Yeah. Here's a good question. It is very, very smoky and hazy and not great up in the Northeast. Cessna 4, my good friend Jason, he said, how much, if any, effect will the wildfire smoke haze have on private jet operations? We can also throw airlines in there too, because I think there is a little bit of a difference between the two. Not necessarily how they operate or how engines ingest smoke or ash or whatever it is, but the fact that a private jet doesn't have to go to the one big airport. There is a million, not really a million, but there are hundreds of other airports in the Northeast that any private jet could find wherever the smoke isn't as bad to go land. Where an airline, you're very much, you have to go to either your destination, or if you're going to go somewhere else and go to alternate, you have to have some kind of support there. Obviously, if there's an emergency, you can land wherever you want, but it's much more difficult for an airline to just go like, hey, the weather's better in wherever, we're going to go land there. Or a private jet, you can be like, oh yeah, weather's good here, let's go there, we'll get you a limo,
Right. No, there's no doubt that the flexibility of that type of an operation would certainly help, right? I mean, anytime you can, well, I know that's for a fact. That's why a lot of people love the private aviation, just the time savings alone from being able to bypass a LaGuardia or a Hartsfield or an O'Hare or something like that, right? When you can fly into, an airport that still gets you right where you need to go. Regarding the haze, that can be a problem. I mean, we certainly have seen lots of individual disturbances in the past. One of the things that comes to mind is a volcanic ash, which actually, by the way, was not that long ago, just maybe a month or so ago, there was a big plume of volcanic ash that was moving, in the upper troposphere towards over the U.S. and other places. So, the airlines, unfortunately, are limited. And, for the most part, they're used to dealing with some of these disturbances. It just depends if it's long term or not, how long it's going to last. Literally, it depends on the way the wind's going to blow.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting. The FAA actually posted a video on Instagram. It was pretty helpful. It was talking about how all the navigation kind of equipment that we have, it's all tested for water droplets, but it's not tested for any kind of ash or any kind of smoke. So either they don't know or they do know how the plane's going to react. So if they need the extra spacing, it's probably a good reason so they can make sure everyone's going to be navigating safely,
Yeah. And, some of that I think has been tested. There are some well-known universities in the U.S. that do similar type of testing to look at things like that, to look at different types of impacts from different type of atmospheric conditions. So they may know, or they may realize that they have to risk mitigate, like you said, by increasing some of the separation. So we'll keep our eye on it for the next few days and see how it goes. But there certainly has been an impact.
Yeah, and it comes at a really tough time too, right? Summer's coming up. FAA has already warned all airlines, hey, cut back on your summer flying to New York because we got no controllers and we got no ramp workers. We got no one. So don't come. But everyone wants to go to the Northeast. Everyone wants to go to Miami. Everyone wants to fly back and forth. So it's just a mess right now. Absolute mess. I know my company, we fly to Teterboro all the time. Teterboro is packed every single night. They're turning away airplanes saying you have to go to Morristown, you have to go here, you have to go to White Plains, and they're packed and they're literally turning away airplanes because they cannot have any more airplanes on the ramp anymore.
You know, it's funny you bring this up. I just recently did an interview with Politico and spent a lot of time with a reporter who I thought was extremely knowledgeable about our industry, being a non-aviation person. And at the end, they wanted me to say, you know, how do you think the summer is going to be? Because is it going to be like last summer where we had the Southwest meltdown and all the delays and some of the different things? And, you know, my answer was at the time, you know, the airlines have had a year to look at this, to update their technology, but they are going to be adding more flights this summer. There's no doubt about that. We've already seen all that. We've seen a lot of upgauging as well. And so my thought process was, if you're going to make me commit, I think it'll be about the same as last summer. So far, that prediction has not worked out well for me because we're already seeing some things that early on in the summer season that are not so good. So I don't know what's going to happen. I know the ATC, of course, they just don't have enough controllers. They're going through a hiring round right now. But as everyone knows, before a controller gets fully position qualified, and there's a high washout rate on that, by the way, but before a controller gets fully position qualified, say at a center sector or an approach control or even a tower, I mean, that's a 2-year process where they have to be supervised.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, even if you hired, 5,000 controllers tomorrow, they couldn't, no one could do that. You're still a few years away from any kind of a meaningful impact. So there's some system-wide problems and obstacles, systemic, I guess is the word I was looking for, that, don't have any quick solutions.
You know what I don't understand about the whole FAA hiring window? If you are short on controllers, why do you have a window of applicants? Why don't you open it up for a year, 2 years, until you have as many applicants as you need? Because you don't know what someone is in their stage of life. Maybe they got fired. Maybe they're having kind of like a mid-29-year-old crisis where they're like, I need to do something else. I'm going to be an air traffic controller. But if you're not in that specific window, you're never going to apply. What's the point? I will never understand why they have an application note for that when they are so short.
I think that's a really good point, Justin. If you look at the history of FAA controller hiring, it has absolutely been massive changes, policy changes, and a lot of, in my opinion, quite weird concepts over the years. I mean, if you go all the way back to the 80s and 90s, the idea back then is if you came from the military, there was a way, military controllers had a lot of, rightly so, had a lot of ways to get into flying or get into being an air traffic controller. But a civilian, it simply came down to a test. If you remember, there's this air traffic control test you'd go and take. And if you scored high enough, which was actually pretty high, I mean, it was close to like a 99 percentile on there at the time, they would invite you to a slot at Oklahoma City and all the controllers would go through there. That seemed to work for a while, but in the mid 90s to the early 2000s, the colleges started getting involved and they formed the CTIT or CITI? I can't quite remember the acronym, but they started this program, which also did a lot of really good training at the universities. If you've been to any of these major universities, lately that have ATC programs, they have amazing equipment, right? And so these students are going through, they're getting their 4-year degree, but they're also learning how to handle all this traffic and all these different scenarios. So they would go right to Oklahoma City and just go right through it. Well, all of a sudden the FAA decided they didn't want to do that anymore. And so now they're kind of like, some people are going through that program and they get a little bit of a leg up and some people aren't. But I'm with you. I don't know why you would turn the faucet on and off when you clearly have shortages. And there's been some cohorts of controllers. So some of the hiring practices have been poor to where you might get 20%, 25% of the folks through fully to the end. Even if you, like I said, you hire 1,000 controllers, maybe 250 of them end up being able to help you 2 years later. So right. I'm with you. The faucet needs to stay on.
Yeah, and maybe pay them a little more too. I don't know. Maybe that helps.
Right. Right.
But what do I know?
Yeah, they don't ask us, do they, Justin?
No. Well, maybe they're listening. We'll get angry emails from the FAA here soon. Be like, what are you guys talking about? Don't put that out there.
The first time in my career I got an angry email. Yeah,
I like to stay. I don't like to stay away from them. I like them to not know who I am. So that way, let's keep it that way. This is all Jim. This is not me. I promise.
I will tell you regarding the FAA really quickly. I was sad to see the. I guess he was the interim administrator, Nolan, leave. In my opinion, he was one of the better FAA administrators we've seen in some time. And I don't know the next interim that comes in. I hope that they'll be competent. But you know, if you look back at the history of our FAA administrators, we've only had a handful of people, in my opinion, that have really done a good job changing things. I mean, I go back as far as Jane Garvey. I'm sure there were some before her, but she clearly did a very good job. I also think more recently, Randy Babbitt. And we got to talk about that story sometime. And one of the most unfair dismissals from a job ever. That's a whole story we can talk about at some point. It'll really make you upset. But Randy Babbitt, of course, brought the flight time, duty time stuff, and he was well on his way. He did the fatigue risk mitigation stuff. You know, he was well on his way to making some really good changes for the positive. And of course, he left. And then we had Nolan in there for a while, and I thought he did really well. But, you know, we still have some big systemic problems with the FAA. They still have big problems with their next gen. You know, we hear about it a lot. But, I mean, how many decades now are we going to hear about next gen? And we're starting to see some of it integrate, but not much. And, of course, there's the UAS problem. When are we, you know, the drone integration into the airspace? Just huge issues that we really need to get an administrator in there that will solve this quickly. And I don't know when that's going to happen, but we all deserve, the industry and the country deserve that.
You know, what's funny is I was mostly joking, but actually I wasn't, I think it'd be cool. When that came out, I put on my Instagram, I was like, yo, FAA, if you ever need anyone to run it, let me know. It's like, hey, how does someone become the head of the FAA? It's like, do I just like DM them on Instagram? How does this work? But I think that would, I don't know why, maybe I'm crazy. It's probably not a cool job, but I think that would actually be a really fun job to have if you ever were able to get that kind of job. Have the opportunity to try to make change. And I know people always go to Washington with hopes that they make change and they get eat up and chewed and spit right back out. But I just feel like the opportunity to be there, especially right now where there's so much going on in aviation and it's really kind of entering a new world almost, right? Like, I don't want to say 5G because that's obviously, I mean, 5G has to do with automation, but like the automation that's coming up with single pilot threats, with drones, with eVTOLs, with all this, there's so much stuff going on right now. And there's also just the basics of quality of life. There's, 135 rest rules right now that the FAA is kind of just like thrown to the side because they don't want to deal with it right now, which obviously I'm a 135.91 guy. So I put that at the top of the sphere, not like putting it out there for people I'm going to run on, but right. I feel like it'd be a cool job.
Yeah. I have known a few FAA administrators. I've certainly been in meetings with them in the past. I guess if you're looking for the conventional wisdom, it really depends on who's in the White House when there's a vacancy, right? So generally speaking, if you look back at the history, and this hasn't always been the case, but you know, if like when we had Trump in there, he put in the Delta VP of Flight Ops, Steve Dixon, who I've been on a couple committees with in the past. Really, really sharp guy. I mean, really, really sharp guy. But there's an element of politics, right? So, and then when you get a more of a Democratic White House in there, you'll see them generally take someone from labor or someone along those lines. And that's how Randy Babbitt, who was a former ALPA president, got in. So, you know, that's generally how it is. So how do you get a job like that? I do think there's definitely an element of politics. You know, depending on who's in power, if you're aligned with that party, you probably have a better shot for sure. You know, again, they've missed, in my opinion, over the years on getting some good, high quality administrators in there. You know, not, of course, the ones I mentioned. I thought they were really good. But some people, I think, have been good managers, you know, in terms of like, you know, there's not any huge progress, but they've certainly not messed it up. But I just think it's difficult to get an operational person in there, which I agree would be fantastic. You just don't see very often.
Yeah. And pilots are historically bad at running things. So it's probably for the best. Right? Yeah. It's probably for the best.
Right.
Let's take a break and hear from our sponsor, RAA. For pilots, career transitions not only come with new professional challenges, but also major changes to your personal life and your money. As airline specialized advisors, RAA is here to help guide you through each financial transition with clarity and confidence. Starting with three free planning tools available at raa.com/pilot to pilot including From the Right Seat to the Left Seat, Your Guide to Key Financial Factors to Consider When Upgrading to Captain, which is very beneficial for me because I'm currently upgrading to captain, From the Left Seat to the Back Seat, outlining smart tips to help pilots and spouses make a smooth adjustment to life and retirement, plus a 401k calculator that lets you see how a change in seat, equipment, or early retirement could impact your retirement savings. Download the complete toolkit for free at raa.com/pilot2pilot. Then schedule a complimentary consultation with an RAA advisor today to learn more. Check out raa.com/pilot2pilot. Now back to today's episode. One interesting thing that has kind of been on the news, which if it was an airline, it would be way more talked about, but the single pilot or the jet that just went down in Virginia, the question is, with the crash of the single pilot jet, do you think the government will mandate two pilots for all operations? I'm going to say no. I do not think that will. I just don't think that, I don't know how to say this without being like rude, but I don't even know if I want to go there, but I just don't think it's going to happen. I do not think it's going to happen.
a fancy way to go where I think you were going to go is to say it's a risk, a cost benefit type of analysis that they'll conduct. And that is how the FAA generally conducts things like this. The thing that will throw that off is if public sentiment overrides that. You are 100% correct that the people are going to, I've already seen it on my social media feeds. I'm sure you've seen it on yours. That's going to be an issue that is going to absolutely be grabbed by the groups, chiefly the unions, and say, hey, this is what could happen. Now, we don't know exactly what happened. It certainly looks like it was some type of an incapacitation, whether it's hypoxia or some other type of incapacitation inducement, we certainly have seen this. It's been a long time. You probably before you were born, Justin, Payne the Payne Stewart accident. Yeah. So, we have seen stuff like this before. I just always wonder how, I guess if the warning systems aren't working, I guess that's what happens. I have personally gone through altitude chamber training, so I know my own hypoxic symptoms. And now some of the hypoxia training you can get done very cheaply because you don't have to go into a full blown altitude chamber. You can go into, like even athletes use it for training and stuff where you can go into, I forget what it is, but it looks like kind of a plastic tent and you can go in there and figure out what your symptoms are. I do think that you might see some efforts on that part. If you're going to be a single pilot, then you have to go through this type of training or something like that. I could see somebody doing that. But again, it's going to be based on the risk. And you're exactly right. I don't think there's going to be, at least in the next few years, it'd be really unlikely to see some kind of far-reaching mandate come out, especially given the political climate of pilot shortages and the power that a lot of people that fly these jets have. So I think it'll be kind of, I agree with your sentiment on it.
Well, I mean, and also, I don't want to say it's going to happen, but in the future, they're going to want to try to remove one pilot from all 121 operators or whatever, if it's cargo or whatever it is. So if they now say, hey, you need two pilots to fly an old Citation, then they really have no argument of taking out the other pilot in 10 years when they decide that technology is finally there to take them out. So like, if that's what they want to do, then they honestly cannot make that ruling right now, or else there's no way they could get their hopes and dreams passed.
Well, you're certainly correct. And if you're ALPA and CAPA and some of the other groups out there that are really pushing hard to eliminate the single pilot talk at in the 121 world, this would be a great battle for you to fight, right? Because you're very much, to your point, you're very much upstream. And you would virtually make it impossible for many years. What I think is going to end up happening more than likely is we are going to see caving in on that single pilot thing. I think you're going to see it on the foreign carriers first. Perhaps you already have. We've talked a little bit about the MPL and some of the other things in the past. And so that's probably where you're going to see it. Now, whether or not it migrates over here, it's going to be fought off for years. I do get that question. I'm sure you do from my students. If I spend 30 years in the industry, are there going to be jobs for me in the last 10, 15 years? I don't know when the automation is going to, the automation will happen a long time before the regulatory approval process will. I don't know when that regulatory approval process will happen where you start seeing pilots reduce. I do think it's inevitable and people really get mad at me when I say that, but I just think it is. That being said, certainly today we're not even close to that that area. But yeah, to your point, I like the way you're thinking on that very strategically. That's what I would call a tactic. It certainly would be a good tactic if somebody is really trying to fight against that whole narrative of allowing just a single pilot. That's exactly where you'd want to draw a line.
Yeah, and I kind of align with you where I think it's an inevitable. I can't talk. I think it is inevitable that it will happen. I mean, I will flat out say it. I do not think my kid, who is 1.5, I don't think he will have a career as an airline pilot. I just don't think that that'll be there. And if he does, it won't be until he's 65, unless he's the only the single pilot that's operating the plane. You know, I just don't think it's going to be there. But how fast? I don't know. Did we think AI was going to come around this fast? I personally didn't. I feel like we always talked about AI and how it was going to come and come and come and come, but it was still way down the line. Then all of a sudden ChatGPT came out and it kind of changed the whole game. So you don't know who is working on something right now that has the capability to really speed this up, which I think that's the scariest thing, is that it's what you don't know and who's working on something that can really come in and disrupt the space.
Well, generative AI that we're seeing and the pace of it, certainly we're seeing a shift, right? We might have mentioned this before, but it certainly reminds me of when the internet started becoming really, really big. I was there for that in college, you know, when the browser came out, and I remember thinking, oh, this could be really big someday, right? And that was in 1993, and that was the internet. I feel that same way about this. I kind of felt the same way about unmanned. You know, when drones first started kind of rearing their head in the late 2000s, 2007, 2008, a lot of people were like, hey, this is going to be a big thing. I'm like, you know, it kind of feels that way, you know, like a big paradigm shift. So, I think you're right. I mean, you know, the romantic aviator guy in me, you know, would love to always see, you know, people up there. And certainly I know enough about AI. I know enough about algorithms and optimization that today there's no way I would trust any of that. But like you said, we're moving now at an accelerated clip. Just in the last few months, chip manufacturers are now making chips that are optimized for this new generative AI. So it's just like everything else that's happened. We're going to start seeing an exponential growth. It's not going to be just, oh, here's a milestone. We're now going to see things discovered that we had never thought of. I mean, again, not to get too theoretical, and maybe people are going to start tuning this out, but just the other day, a new way of computer coding was found by AI, the same people at Google, the AlphaGo people. For the first time in like 15 years, they updated the library for the C coding language. They found a way that optimized computer sorting, which is something that humans thought were optimized for the last 15 years. This found a way to optimize lists of four or more objects in a much faster way. And it just blows your mind when you think about that. This wasn't even on anyone's thought process. We thought all this had been settled. And no, it turns out there are new ways, and AI is discovering it. So it's scary. It's fascinating and inevitable is the way I see it.
Yep, for sure. Let's see what else we got. Don't want to be too doom and gloom on that. DOJ, JetBlue, American, what's the latest on that? Well, obviously the latest is that they want to block it, but, one, does JetBlue still really believe in that now that they have Spirit? Is it still like a necessity for them? And two, what's the next step?
Well, the DOJ won its lawsuit, you know, and so there could be appeals and we'll see how it goes. I don't know if there's going to be appeals. Just so everyone knows, this had to do with a kind of a really robust code sharing agreement between American and JetBlue. American and JetBlue realized they probably would never be able to merge. Not that I know, I don't have any insight if there was ever any talks about merging. But one of the next best things you can do to increase your network, if you're not going to merge, is you can do these robust code sharing alliance type agreements. Well, they had proposed to do that, and the DOJ moved in, filed a lawsuit saying it was too anti-competitive, and they won. They won, I think it was a week ago or so. Federal court said, yeah, you can't do it. So all eyes will be on the response. You know, how much does JetBlue and America want to fight this? Are they going to appeal it? My guess is they'll probably appeal it. But like you said, there's plenty of activity elsewhere for both carriers right now. So it's not like they don't have anything to do. But that being said, I think you will see them probably still try to move forward with it. But right now is the day. Judge is saying no dice.
Which further proves the fact that they would never be allowed to merge if they ever thought about it.
Yeah. I mean, mergers are going to come under a lot of, they always come under scrutiny, but you're going to see a lot of scrutiny now with those types of things.
And if I'm not mistaken, didn't JetBlue put it up to a vote to the pilots and the pilots said no, and then they did it anyway?
You know, I'm not sure about that, but that would be interesting.
I may be wrong and it may be something completely different. And I might've read a text wrong from a buddy that works there, but I was almost certain that they were like, they put it up for a vote. Everyone said no. And they're like, well, we're going to do it anyways.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me if the union put it out for a vote, a referendum of some type. I don't know. I mean, the company, it would be interesting for the company to do that. I don't know. We'll see. You know, if you're JetBlue and you're worried about merging with American, I mean, just ask the TWA pilots who ultimately also won in court, but it took many, many years. But historically, mergers have not gone very well for the smaller carrier with American in general. So I can see why there'd be some trepidation with some of those folks.
Yeah, definitely. All right, let's see what else we got here. Okay, here we go. Another question has to do with FedEx. And obviously, FedEx, like we mentioned, we didn't really talk about it too much, but they have a new AIP. But FedEx is also very interesting because they also have kind of stopped hiring at this point, right? Unless they picked it back up recently.
No, nope, you're right.
To come out with an agreement in principle and stop hiring a couple months ago. I thought it was kind of a tactic by management to do that. Just kind of like say, hey, times aren't really great right now. But now that they have an agreement in principle, they haven't like rushed to let everyone come back in. So who knows if it could still be tactics or maybe they just truly don't think they need to hire anyone.
Well, I know freight carriers have been accused of that in the past. I know in UPS's case, for instance, they've constantly been accused of not hiring pilots to demonstrate that that things are fine. Not that we're talking about UPS, but the question is that transferred to FedEx? FedEx has had a legitimate, I'm going to call it a slowdown, but let me just explain that there's some context there. As we all know, FedEx was going into a slowdown prior to the pandemic. They were looking at shutting down some things. They were looking at retrenching a little bit. And then, of course, all of a sudden COVID hits, right? And we all know what happened with air freight with COVID. It just, went through the roof. And so then all of a sudden FedEx started turning in record years. And I think I mentioned it before, but instead of having a 2-month peak period, the entire year was a peak period for them. And so things were going really, really well, and they went way above their baseline. And so now, the question is what do you want to call it? They've certainly have slowed down in their revenue growth and, freight shipments and a lot of the metrics that we look at, but it's still above where they were prior to the pandemic. So, is it a slowdown? It's certainly a slowdown from the pandemic highs. I think it was not unexpected. It would have been really hard to keep that pace up. So I don't know that's a tactic. I think it's probably my gut feeling is, it's probably a legitimate response to market conditions. But that being said, FedEx is a very interesting thing for a pilot. I think some pilots, they don't understand how I haven't seen the AIP, but the previous contract, I thought was a really strong contract. What people don't realize is FedEx has mostly wide bodies. I think they might still have some 757s, which I think in the contract is still considered narrow body. But certainly from the 76s on. And so when you think about that, the vast majority of the pilots there are flying on wide body rates. So if you go to work for United, American, Delta, you're probably going to start off on a narrow body or, before you could ever upgrade to captain, you're going to be in a narrow body. But that's not the case at a place like FedEx. So you're going to go right into those really good, paying positions that a lot of people don't consider. The big knock on FedEx and UPS for this matter, from a pilot point of view, has always been hours of flying, right? I think I might've mentioned this before, my dad retired at UPS as a pilot. And I will tell you, the overnight flying there was absolutely atrocious on his health. It just was. I can tell you the time he spent there, it aged him. He was a workout fiend. He was a fanatic and still aged him quite a bit. So the thing though now is places like FedEx, they have a lot of daytime flying. In fact, their day sorts are almost as big as their night sorts almost. And so there is a lot of flying, different types of flying there for everybody. And you do get right into the wide body. So I still think it's, I get this question every now and then. I still think FedEx and UPS contracts are still by far the best contracts in terms of work rules and pay in the industry. The downside is, you know, the hours worked and, you know, the overnight schedules in many cases. You know, my wife, she flies for an airline and she just can't do the overnights, the red eyes. She just absolutely detests them because just is really tough on her. And so it's really a big issue for a lot of people. Back onto the AIP, let's see what's in there. I know one thing that shook out of it was a new retirement type of scheme, which is really interesting because, you know, for those of you that are into investing for your retirement, the government sets limits. You can only have so much money go into your retirement funds. It's mandated by law. And so the FedEx pilots, long before any other pilot group that I know of, ran into problems where they're hitting all their limits and all their available retirement programs. All their contributions were maxed out. And so they found some kind of a new program. I don't know the details of it. I was just reading about it, but it's some kind of a new program that allows them to further invest in their retirement. So that's new, and that's going to be really interesting to watch. And I don't know if that, you know, if someone's looking for a big long-term play at a really comfortable airline, you know, FedEx would be at the top of my list for some of these reasons. I guess I was a little long-winded there, Justin. But
no, you're fine. But this also goes back to the fact that freight might be the first one to automate. So,
there's no doubt about that. Yeah. There's absolutely no doubt about that. If you look at the technology offices at both UPS and FedEx and some of the other freight carriers worldwide, they absolutely already have teams that are working on this. And if you think about it from a public acceptance point of view, if you look at risk mitigation as your driver, there's just simply less risk in terms of human lives. I mean, this is really offensive if you're a pilot and for one of those carriers. But from the FAA's cold, hard calculation of risk mitigation, there simply is less risk because there's less human lives involved. So if you're going to start seeing it, and we've mentioned this before, you'll start seeing it on the augmented crews first, where you'll start seeing some of that automated is my guess. You know, so you maybe don't have to bring as many people on each flight to fly the 16-hour flight, you know, to Sydney, you know, but we'll see. I mean, you know, I still think we're a few years away from that. But yes, they have started efforts in earnest in these areas.
The moral of the story is if you can get hired by FedEx, UPS, a major airline, Southwest, even JetBlue, most airlines, you're going to have a good career. You're still going to be able to, unless things change drastically. So don't hold me to it. Don't take me to court over it, but you should be able to get a pretty good career out of it and make a lot of money if things stay as they are. So
agreed. I would even go further to say even some of the other low cost carriers, the Frontiers and I mean, maybe even the Spirits, I have a lot of friends at Spirit. You know, the truth is these have a lot of growth plans. These companies have a lot of growth plans, which often mean there's good opportunities for the pilots. They're having a hard time attracting pilots. And so what that means to me is from a market point of view, you're going to start seeing some adjustments there where they make some pretty good adjustments. The truth is each pilot has to make their decision based on everything, where they want to live is a big one. You know, how often they want to fly, you know, what do they want to fly? Where do they want to fly? These are all big things that go into that giant equation that's very personalized for each individual pilot. But your sentiment is right on point. No matter where you go, it's all relative, right? You know, I used to work stacking hay bales in high school. Hardest job I've ever had in my life, 80-pound hay bales, and you'd stack them, you know. I remember thinking to myself, I just couldn't imagine doing this for the rest of my life. Then I worked as at a freight carrier, right? And I thought, oh, man, this is so much better than stacking hay. And then I went to work for a regional, right? And I was like, oh, man, that's so much better. My wife just went from a regional to a major, and it's just everything keeps getting better, and it gets all relative. So yes, yes, and yes to your answers, no matter where you get your job at, if it satisfies your personal equation for where you need to be and where you need to go, it's going to be a great career.
What's funny about you kind of mentioning how it's just going to get better, that is true. But to a point, say you get to where you think you're going to be with the rest of your life, or even you get to a spot in the middle. If you were there for 3-5 years, that's when you start kind of thinking like, you know what, this place kind of sucks. I'm not too happy right now. You know, like you forget about how bad your last job was and you start focusing on how bad it is where you are right now. And that happens everywhere. I mean, it could just be a contract thing for a lot of places, but in aviation, you're going to deal with the same BS essentially that you deal with almost every single job. It gets a little bit better. It gets better in certain areas. The planes get better. Maintenance gets better and all that kind of stuff. You don't have to fear for your life as much as you did in the small 135 freight, but there's still a lot of crap that you're going to have to put up with. You just get paid a lot more when you get to the major airlines.
Well, that, and it's a lot of responsibility and certainly a hard job, and not everyone can do it. So you're absolutely right. There's always going to be things that need to be improved. I do have to make a couple jokes, and I can do this as a former union leader and also airline pilot. But, I hope she doesn't listen to this, but, you know, my wife, she was so happy to get hired at her airline. And it's been a great, they've treated her super well, and, you know, things have been going well. They're in contract talks too. The first thing she talked about is these crew meals, right? You know, at the region, she never got crew. I mean, my crew meal at, American Eagle, where the Biscoff, little wafers you get. Yeah, that was my crew meal. But here, she was just so excited to get these crew meals. I noticed the other day, I said, "Hey, how are those crew meals?" She's like, the chicken's been a little dry. goes to your point that the crew meal is just a fantastic thing, but then after a while you get used to it, and all of a sudden you're like, it can be improved. So it absolutely can. It's a never ending journey, and I do think we're starting to get some really good life improvements. I do think the generation, I'm just gonna sound like an old man again, but the generation coming in, they definitely are a little more focused on work life balance. Maybe than some previous generations were. And so the airlines are going to have to accommodate that. They're going to have to figure out how to make those schedules work a little bit better. I do think system-wide, there could be big improvements in PBS systems. Some of these PBS systems that are running at these airlines have been there since the 90s. And I got to tell you, computational power has really gotten a lot better in the last 25 years. And so these need to be upgraded. I think you'll see huge benefits for quality of life and some of those really important issues for folks coming in.
Yeah. Let's hope so, because I have a long career left in aviation. So I want to see those benefits. But Jim, thank you so much for going on the podcast. It's always fun to talk to you. We'll see you again soon.
Sounds good, Justin. Always happy to be here.
Absolutely. Have a good one.
Yeah.
That's a wrap on today's podcast. Thank you so much for listening. As I always say, grab your parents' phone, your friend's phone, take it, download the podcast on Spotify, Apple, iTunes. Who knows? Maybe we'll have a new pilot in the family. So do that for me. It'd be amazing. But Aviation, I hope you're having a great day. And as always, happy flying.